The end of his tortured quest, the fulfillment of more than his wishes, not the wreck of her plane and her body, but her living presence and his freedom. All that he was seeking or had ever sought was now spread open before him, open and waiting, his to be reached by a straight-line dive through the pure, clear air. His, and asking nothing of him but the capacity to see. "Hank!" she screamed, waving her arms in desperate signal. "Hank!" She fell back against the rock, knowing that she had no way to reach him, that she had no power to give him sight, that no power on earth could pierce that screen except his own mind and vision. Suddenly, and for the first time, she felt the screen, not as the most intangible, but as the most grimly absolute barrier in the world. Slumped against the rock, she watched, in silent resignation, the hopeless circles of the plane's struggle and its motor's uncomplaining cry for help, a cry she had no way to answer. The plane swooped down abruptly, but it was only the start of its final rise. It cut a swift diagonal across the mountains and shot into the open sky. Then, as if caught in the spread of a lake with no shores and no exit, it went sinking slowly and drowning out of sight. She thought, in bitter compassion, of how much he had failed to see. "And I," she thought. If she left the valley, the screen would close for her as tightly. Atlantis would descend under a vault of rays more impregnable than the bottom of the ocean, and she, too, would be left to struggle for the things she had not known how to see. She, too, would be left to fight a mirage of primordial savagery, while the reality of all that she desired would never come again within her reach. But the pull of the outer world, the pull that drew her to follow the plane, was not the image of Hank Reardon. She knew that she could not return to him, even if she returned to the world. The pull was the vision of Hank Reardon's courage, and the courage of all those still fighting to stay alive. He would not give up the search for her plane, when all others had long since despaired, as he would not give up his mills, as he would not give up any goal he had chosen if a single chance was left. Was she certain that no chance remained for the world of Taggart Transcontinental? Was she certain that the terms of the battle were such that she could not care to win? They were right, the men of Atlantis. They were right to vanish if they knew that they left no value behind them. But until and unless she saw that no chance was untaken and no battle unfought, she had no right to remain among them. This was the question that had lashed her for weeks, but had not driven her to a glimpse of the answer. She lay awake through the hours of that night, quietly motionless, following, like an engineer and like Hank Reardon, a process of dispassionate, precise, almost mathematical consideration, with no regard for cost or feeling. The agony which he lived in his plane, she lived it in a soundless cube of darkness, searching, but finding no answer. She looked at the inscriptions on the walls of her room, faintly visible in patches of starlight, but the help those men had called in their darkest hour was not hers to call. "Yes or no, Miss Taggart?" She looked at the faces of the four men in the soft twilight of Mulligan's living room. Galt, whose face had the serene, impersonal attentiveness of a scientist. Francisco, whose face was made expressionless by the hint of a smile, the kind of smile that would fit either answer. Hugh Axton, who looked compassionately gentle. Midas Mulligan, who had asked the question with no touch of rancor in his voice. Somewhere 2,000 miles away, at this sunset hour, the page of a calendar was springing into light over the roofs of New York, saying, June 28th. And it seemed to her suddenly that she was seeing it, as if it were hanging over the heads of these men. "I have one more day," she said steadily. "Will you let me have it? I think I've reached my decision, but I am not fully certain of it, and I'll need all the certainty possible to me." "Of course," said Mulligan. "You have, in fact, until morning of the day after tomorrow. We'll wait." "We'll wait after that as well," said Hugh Axton, "though in your absence, if that be necessary." She stood by the window facing them, and she felt a moment's satisfaction in the knowledge that she stood straight, that her hands did not tremble, that her voice sounded as controlled, uncomplaining, and unpitying as theirs. It gave her a moment's feeling of a bond to them. "If any part of your uncertainty," said Galt, "is a conflict between your heart and your mind, follow your mind. Consider the reasons which make us certain that we are right," said Hugh Axton, "but not the fact that we are certain. If you are not convinced, ignore our certainty. Don't be tempted to substitute our judgment for your own. Don't rely on our knowledge of what's best for your future," said Mulligan. "We do know, but it can't be best until you know it." "Don't consider our interests or desires," said Francisco. "You have no duty to anyone but yourself." She smiled, neither sadly nor gaily, thinking that none of it was the sort of advice she would have been given in the outer world. And knowing how desperately they wished to help her where no help was possible, she felt it was her part to give them reassurance. "I forced my way here," she said quietly, "and I was to bear responsibility for the consequences. I'm bearing it." Her reward was to see Galt smile. The smile was like a military decoration bestowed upon her. Looking away, she remembered suddenly Jeff Allen, the tramp aboard the Comet, in the moment when she had admired him for attempting to tell her that he knew where he was going, to spare her the burden of his aimlessness. She smiled faintly, thinking that she had now experienced it in both roles, and knew that no action could be lower or more futile than for one person to throw upon another the burden of his abdication of choice. She felt an odd calm, almost a confident repose. She knew that it was tension, but the tension of a great clarity. She caught herself thinking, "She's functioning well in an emergency. I'll be all right with her." And realized that she was thinking of herself. "Let it go till day after tomorrow, Miss Taggart," said Midas Mulligan. "Tonight you are still here." "Thank you," she said. She remained by the window while they went on discussing the Valley's business. It was their closing conference of the month. They had just finished dinner, and she thought of her first dinner in this house a month ago. She was wearing, as she had then worn, the gray suit that belonged in her office, not the peasant skirt that had been so easy to wear in the sun. "I'm still here tonight," she thought, her hand pressed possessively to the window sill. The sun had not yet vanished beyond the mountains, but the sky was an even, deep, deceptively clear blue that blended with the blue of invisible clouds into a single spread, hiding the sun. Only the edges of the clouds were outlined by a thin thread of flame, and it looked like a glowing, twisted net of neon tubing, she thought, like a chart of winding rivers, like the map of a railroad traced in white fire on the sky. She heard Mulligan giving Galt the names of those who were not returning to the outer world. "We have jobs for all of them," said Mulligan. "In fact, there's only 10 or 12 men who are going back this year. Mostly to finish off, convert whatever they own, and come here permanently. I think this was our last vacation month, because before another year is over, we'll all be living in this valley."
"Good,"
said Galt. "We'll have to, from the way things are going outside."
"Yes."
"Francisco," said Mulligan, "you'll come back in a few months."
"In November at the latest," said Francisco. "I'll send you word by shortwave when I'm ready to come back. Will you turn the furnace on in my house?"
"I will," said Hugh Axton, "and I'll have your supper ready for you when you arrive." "John, I take it for granted," said Mulligan, "that you're not returning to New York this time." Galt took a moment to glance at him, then answered evenly, "I have not decided it yet." She noticed the shocked swiftness with which Francisco and Mulligan bent forward to stare at him, and the slowness with which Hugh Axton's glance moved to his face. Axton did not seem to be astonished.
"You're not thinking of going back to that hell for another year, are you?" said Mulligan.
"I am."
"But, good God, John, what for?"
I'll tell you when I've decided. But there's nothing left there for you to do. We got everybody we knew of or can hope to know of. Our list is completed, except for Hank Reardon, and we'll get him before the year is over, and Miss Taggart, if she so chooses. That's all. Your job is done. There's nothing to look for out there, except the final crash, when the roof comes down on their heads. I know it. John, yours is the one head I don't want to be there when it happens. You've never had to worry about me. But don't you realize what stage they're coming to? They're only one step away from open violence. Hell, they've taken the step and sealed and declared it long ago. But in one more moment, they'll see the full reality of what they've taken, exploding in their damn faces. Plain, open, blind, arbitrary, blood-shedding violence, running amok, hitting anything and anyone at random. That's what I don't want to see you in the midst of. I can take care of myself. John, there's no reason for you to take the risk, said Francisco. What risk? The looters are worried about the men who've disappeared. They're suspecting something. You, of all people, shouldn't stay there any longer. There's always a chance that they might discover just who and what you are. There's some chance. Not much. But there's no reason whatever to take it. There's nothing left that Ragnar and I can't finish. Hugh Axton was watching them silently, leaning back in his chair. His face had that look of intensity, neither quite bitterness nor quite a smile, with which a man watches a progression that interests him, but that lags a few steps behind his vision. If I go back, said Galt, it won't be for our work. It will be to win the only thing I want from the world for myself, now that the work is done. I've taken nothing from the world, and I've wanted nothing. But there's one thing which it's still holding, and which is mine, and which I won't let it have. No, I don't intend to break my oath. I won't deal with the looters. I won't be of any value or help to anyone out there. Neither to looters, nor neutrals, nor scabs. If I go, it won't be for anyone's sake but mine. And I don't think I'm risking my life. But if I am, well, I'm now free to risk it. He was not looking at her, but she had to turn away and stand pressed against the window frame, because her hands were trembling. "But John," cried Mulligan, waving his arm at the valley. "If anything happens to you, what would we—" He stopped abruptly and guiltily. Galt chuckled. "What were you about to say?" Mulligan waved his hand sheepishly in a gesture of dismissal. "Were you about to say that if anything happens to me, I'll die as the worst failure in the world?" "All right," said Mulligan guiltily. "I won't say it. I won't say that we couldn't get along without you. We can. I won't beg you to stay here for our sake. I didn't think I'd ever revert to that rotten old plea, but boy, what a temptation it was. I can almost see why people do it. I know that whatever it is you want, if you wish to risk your life, that's all there is to it. But I'm thinking only that it's... Oh, God, John, it's such a valuable life." Galt smiled. "I know it. That's why I don't think I'm risking it. I think I'll win." Francisco was now silent. He was watching Galt intently, with a frown of wonder, not as if he had found an answer, but as if he had suddenly glimpsed a question. "Look, John," said Mulligan, "since you haven't decided whether you'll go, you haven't decided it yet, have you?" "No, not yet." "Since you haven't, would you let me remind you of a few things, just for you to consider?"
"Go ahead."
"It's the chance dangers that I'm afraid of. The senseless, unpredictable dangers of a world falling apart. Consider the physical risks of complex machinery in the hands of blind fools and fear-crazed cowards. Just think of their railroad. You'd be taking a chance on some such horror as that Winston Tunnel incident every time you stepped aboard a train. And there will be more incidents of that kind, coming faster and faster. They'll reach the stage where no day will pass without a major wreck.
I know it.
And the same will be happening in every other industry, wherever machines are used. The machines which they thought could replace our minds. Plane crashes, oil tank explosions, blast furnace breakouts, high-tension wire electrocutions, subway cave-ins and trestle collapses. They'll see them all. The very machines that had made their life so safe will now make it a continuous peril.
I know it.
I know that you know it, but have you considered it in every specific detail? Have you allowed yourself to visualize it? I want you to see the exact picture of what it is that you propose to enter, before you decide whether anything can justify your entering it. You know that the cities will be hit worst of all. The cities were made by the railroads and will go with them.
That's right.
When the rails are cut, the city of New York will starve in 2 days. That's all the supply of food it's got. It's fed by a continent 3,000 miles long. How will they carry food to New York? By directive and ox cart? But first, before it happens, they'll go through the whole of the agony, through the shrinking, the shortages, the hunger riots, the stampeding violence in the midst of the growing stillness. They will. They'll lose their airplanes first, then their automobiles, then their trucks, then their horse carts. They will. Their factories will stop, then their furnaces and their radios. Then their electric light system will go.
It will.
There's only a worn thread holding that continent together. There will be one train a day, then one train a week. Then the Taggart Bridge will collapse and...
No, it won't.
It was her voice, and they whirled to her. Her face was white, but calmer than it had been when she had answered them last. Slowly, Galt rose to his feet and inclined his head, as in acceptance of a verdict.
You've made your decision, he said.
I have.
Dagny, said Hugh Axton,
I'm sorry.
He spoke softly, with effort, as if his words were struggling and failing to fill the silence of the room.
I wish it were possible not to see this happen. I would have preferred anything.
Except to see you stay here by default of the courage of your convictions. She spread her hands, palms out, her arms at her sides, in a gesture of simple frankness, and said, addressing them all, her manner so calm that she could afford to show emotion,
I want you to know this. I have wished it were possible for me to die in one more month, so that I could spend it in this valley. This is how much I've wanted to remain. But so long as I choose to go on living, I can't desert a battle which I think is mine to fight.
Of course, said Mulligan respectfully, if you still think it.
If you want to know the one reason that's taking me back, I'll tell you. I cannot bring myself to abandon to destruction all the greatness of the world, all that which was mine and yours, which was made by us and is still ours by right, because I cannot believe that men can refuse to see, that they can remain blind and deaf to us forever when the truth is ours and their lives depend on accepting it. They still love their lives, and that is the uncorrupted remnant of their minds. So long as men desire to live, I cannot lose my battle.
Do they? Said Hugh Axton softly.
Do they desire it?
No, don't answer me now.
I know that the answer was the hardest thing for any of us to grasp and to accept. Just take that question back with you, as the last premise left for you to check.
You're leaving as our friend, said Midas Mulligan, and we'll be fighting everything you'll do because we know you're wrong. But it's not you that we'll be damning.
You'll come back, said Hugh Axton, because yours is an error of knowledge, not a moral failure, not an act of surrender to evil, but only the last act of being victim to your own virtue. We'll wait for you.
and Agni, when you come back, you will have discovered that there need never be any conflict among your desires, nor so tragic a clash of values as the one you've borne so well.
Thank you, she said, closing her eyes.
We must discuss the conditions of your departure, said Galt. He spoke in the dispassionate manner of an executive. First, you must give us your word that you will not disclose our secret or any part of it. Neither our cause nor our existence, nor this valley, nor your whereabouts for the past month, to anyone in the outer world, not at any time or for any purpose whatsoever.
I give you my word.
Second, you must never attempt to find this valley again. You are not to come here uninvited. Should you break the first condition, it will not place us in serious danger. Should you break the second, it will. It is not our policy ever to be at the arbitrary mercy of the good faith of another person, or at the mercy of a promise that cannot be enforced. Nor can we expect you to place our interests above your own. Since you believe that your course is right, the day may come when you may find it necessary to lead our enemies to this valley. We shall therefore leave you no means to do it. You will be taken out of the valley by plane, blindfolded, and you will be flown a distance sufficient to make it impossible for you ever to retrace the course.
She inclined her head. You are right.
Your plane has been repaired. Do you wish to reclaim it by signing a draft on your account at the Mulligan Bank?
No.
Then we shall hold it until such time as you choose to pay for it. Day after tomorrow I will take you in my plane to a point outside the valley and leave you within reach of further transportation.
She inclined her head. Very well.
It had grown dark when they left Midas Mulligan's. The trail back to Galt's house led across the valley, past Francisco's cabin, and the three of them walked home together. A few squares of lighted windows hung scattered through the darkness, and the first streams of mist were weaving slowly across the panes, like shadows cast by a distant sea. They walked in silence, but the sound of their steps, blending into a single steady beat, was like a speech to be grasped and not to be uttered in any other form. After a while, Francisco said, "It changes nothing. It only makes the span a little longer, and the last stretch is always the hardest. But it's the last."
"I will hope so," she said.
In a moment she repeated quietly, "The last is the hardest." She turned to Galt.
"May I make one request?"
"Yes."
"Will you let me go tomorrow?"
"If you wish." When Francisco spoke again moments later, it was as if he were addressing the unnamed wonder in her mind. His voice had the tone of answering a question.
"Dagny, all three of us are in love."
She jerked her head to him.
"With the same thing, no matter what its forms. Don't wonder why you feel no breach among us. You'll be one of us, so long as you'll remain in love with your rails and your engines. And they'll lead you back to us, no matter how many times you lose your way. The only man never to be redeemed is the man without passion."
"Thank you," she said softly. "For what?"
For the way you sound."
"How do I sound?" "Name it, Dagny."
"You sound as if you're happy."
"I am. In exactly the same way you are. Don't tell me what you feel. I know it. But you see, the measure of the hell you're able to endure is the measure of your love. The hell I couldn't bear to witness would be to see you being indifferent." She nodded silently, unable to name as joy any part of the things she felt, yet feeling that he was right. Clots of mist were drifting like smoke across the moon, and in the diffused glow she could not distinguish the expressions of their faces as she walked between them. The only expressions to perceive were the straight silhouettes of their bodies, the unbroken sound of their steps, and her own feeling that she wished to walk on and on, a feeling she could not define, except that it was neither doubt nor pain. When they approached his cabin, Francisco stopped, the gesture of his hand embracing them both as he pointed to his door.
"Will you come in? Since it's to be our last night together for some time, let's have a drink to that future of which all three of us are certain."
"Are we?" she asked.
"Yes," said Galt, "we are."
She looked at their faces when Francisco switched on the light in his house. She could not define their expressions. It was not happiness or any emotion pertaining to joy. Their faces were taut and solemn, but it was a glowing solemnity, she thought. If this were possible, and the odd glow she felt within her told her that her own face had the same look.
Francisco reached for three glasses from a cupboard, but stopped, as at a sudden thought. He placed one glass on the table, then reached for the two silver goblets of Sebastian d'Anconia and placed them beside it.
"Are you going straight to New York, Dagny?" he asked, in the calm, unstrained tone of a host bringing out a bottle of old wine.
"Yes," she answered as calmly. "I'm flying to Buenos Aires day after tomorrow," he said, uncorking the bottle. "I'm not sure whether I'll be back in New York later, but if I am, it will be dangerous for you to see me."
"I won't care about that," she said, "unless you feel that I'm not entitled to see you any longer."
"True, Dagny. You're not. Not in New York."
He was pouring the wine and he glanced up at Galt.
"John, when will you decide whether you're going back or staying here?"
Galt looked straight at him, then said slowly, in the tone of a man who knows all the consequences of his words,
"I have decided, Francisco. I'm going back."
Francisco's hand stopped. For a long moment he was seeing nothing but Galt's face. Then his eyes moved to hers. He put the bottle down and he did not step back, but it was as if his glance drew back to a wide range to include them both.
"But of course," he said.
He looked as if he had moved still farther and were now seeing the whole spread of their years. His voice had an even, uninflected sound, a quality that matched the size of the vision.
"I knew it 12 years ago," he said. "I knew it before you could have known, and it's I who should have seen that you would see. That night, when you called us to New York, I thought of it then as—"
He was speaking to Galt, but his eyes moved to Dagny.
"As everything that you were seeking, everything you told us to live for or die if necessary. I should have seen that you would think it too. It could not have been otherwise. It is as it had and ought to be. It was set then, 12 years ago."
He looked at Galt and chuckled softly.
"And you say that it's I who've taken the hardest beating?"
He turned with too swift a movement. Then, too slowly, as if in deliberate emphasis, he completed the task of pouring the wine, filling the three vessels on the table. He picked up the two silver goblets, looked down at them for the pause of an instant, then extended one to Dagny, the other to Galt.
"Take it," he said. "You've earned it, and it wasn't chance."
Galt took the goblet from his hand. But it was as if the acceptance was done by their eyes as they looked at each other.
"I would have given anything to let it be otherwise," said Galt, "except that which is beyond giving."
She held her goblet, she looked at Francisco, and she let him see her eyes glance at Galt.
"Yes," she said in the tone of an answer, "but I have not earned it, and what you've paid, I'm paying it now. And I don't know whether I'll ever earn enough to hold clear title, but if hell is the price and the measure, then let me be the greediest of the three of us."
As they drank, as she stood, her eyes closed, feeling the liquid motion of the wine inside her throat, she knew that for all three of them, this was the most tortured and the most exultant moment they had ever reached. She did not speak to Galt as they walked down the last stretch of the trail to his house.
She did not turn her head to him, feeling that even a glance would be too dangerous. She felt, in their silence, both the calm of a total understanding and the tension of the knowledge that they were not to name the things they understood. But she faced him, when they were in his living room, with full confidence and as if in sudden certainty of a right, the certainty that she would not break and that it was now safe to speak. She said evenly, neither as plea nor as triumph, merely as the statement of a fact,
"You are going back to the outer world, because I will be there."
"Yes."
"I do not want you to go."
"You have no choice about it."
"You are going for my sake."
"No, for mine."
"Will you allow me to see you there?"
"No."
"I am not to see you?"
"No."
"I am not to know where you are or what you do?"
"You're not."
"Will you be watching me, as you did before?"
"More so."
"Is your purpose to protect me?"
"No."
"What is it, then?"
"To be there on the day when you decide to join us." She looked at him attentively, permitting herself no other reaction, but as if groping for an answer to the first point she had not fully understood. "All the rest of us will be gone," he explained. "It will become too dangerous to remain. I will remain as your last key, before the door of this valley closes altogether."
"Oh."
She choked it off before it became a moan. Then, regaining the manner of impersonal detachment, she asked,
"Suppose I were to tell you that my decision is final, and that I am never to join you?"
"It would be a lie."
"Suppose I were now to decide that I wish to make it final and to stand by it, no matter what the future?"
"No matter what future evidence you observe and what convictions you form?"
"Yes."
"That would be worse than a lie."
"You are certain that I have made the wrong decision?"
"I am."
"Do you believe that one must be responsible for one's own errors?"
"I do."
"Then why aren't you letting me bear the consequences of mine?"
"I am, and you will."
"If I find, when it is too late, that I want to return to this valley, why should you have to bear the risk of keeping that door open to me?"
"I don't have to. I wouldn't do it if I had no selfish end to gain."
"What selfish end?"
"I want you here."
She closed her eyes and inclined her head in open admission of defeat. Defeat in the argument and in her attempt to face calmly the full meaning of that which she was leaving. Then she raised her head and, as if she had absorbed his kind of frankness, she looked at him, hiding neither her suffering nor her longing nor her calm, knowing that all three were in her glance. His face was as it had been in the sunlight of the moment when she had seen it for the first time. A face of merciless serenity and unflinching perceptiveness, without pain or fear or guilt. She thought that were it possible for her to stand looking at him, at the straight lines of his eyebrows over the dark green eyes, at the curve of the shadow underscoring the shape of his mouth, at the poured metal planes of his skin in the open collar of his shirt and the casually immovable posture of his legs, she would wish to spend the rest of her life on this spot and in this manner. And in the next instant she knew that if her wish were granted, the contemplation would lose all meaning, because she would have betrayed all the things that gave it value. Then, not as memory, but as an experience of the present, she felt herself reliving the moment when she had stood at the window of her room in New York, looking at a fog-bound city, at the unattainable shape of Atlantis sinking out of reach, and she knew that she was now seeing the answer to that moment. She felt not the words she had then addressed to the city, but that untranslated sensation from which the words had come. "You, whom I have always loved and never found, you whom I expected to see at the end of the rails beyond the horizon."
Aloud, she said, "I want you to know this. I started my life with a single absolute,
but the world was mine to shape in the image of my highest values and never to be given up to a lesser standard, no matter how long or hard the struggle. You, whose presence I had always felt in the streets of the city, the wordless voice within her was saying, and whose world I had wanted to build. Now I know that I was fighting for this valley. It is my love for you that had kept me moving. It was this valley that I saw as possible and would exchange for nothing less and would not give up to a mindless evil. My love and my hope to reach you and my wish to be worthy of you on the day when I would stand before you face to face. I am going back to fight for this valley, to release it from its underground, to regain for it its full and rightful realm, to let the earth belong to you in fact as it does in spirit, and to meet you again on the day when I'm able to deliver to you the whole of the world, or if I fail, to remain in exile from this valley to the end of my life. But what is left of my life will still be yours, and I will go on in your name, even though it is a name I'm never to pronounce. I will go on serving you, even though I'm never to win. I will go on to be worthy of you on the day when I would have met you, even though I won't. I will fight for it, even if I have to fight against you, even if you damn me as a traitor, even if I am never to see you again. He had stood without moving. He had listened with no change in his face. Only his eyes had looked at her as if he were hearing every word, even the words she had not pronounced. He answered with the same look, as if the look were holding some circuit not yet to be broken, his voice catching some tone of hers, as if in signal of the same code, a voice with no sign of emotion except in the spacing of the words. If you fail, as men have failed in their quest for a vision that should have been possible, yet has remained forever beyond their reach. If, like them, you come to think that one's highest values are not to be attained, and one's greatest vision is not to be made real, don't damn this earth as they did. Don't damn existence. You have seen the Atlantis they were seeking. It is here. It exists. But one must enter it naked and alone, with no rags from the falsehoods of centuries, with the purest clarity of mind. Not an innocent heart, but that which is much rarer, an intransigent mind, as one's only possession and key. You will not enter it until you learn that you do not need to convince or to conquer the world. When you learn it, you will see that through all the years of your struggle, nothing had barred you from Atlantis, and there were no chains to hold you, except the chains you were willing to wear. Through all those years, that which you most wished to win was waiting for you. He looked at her as if he were speaking to the unspoken words in her mind, waiting as unremittingly as you were fighting, as passionately, as desperately, but with a greater certainty than yours. Go out to continue your struggle. Go on carrying unchosen burdens, taking undeserved punishment, and believing that justice can be served by the offer of your own spirit to the most unjust of tortures. But in your worst and darkest moments, remember that you have seen another kind of world. Remember that you can reach it whenever you choose to see. Remember that it will be waiting, and that it's real. It's possible. It's yours. Then turning his head a little, his voice as clear, but his eyes breaking the circuit, he asked, "What time do you wish to leave tomorrow?"
"Oh, as early as it will be convenient for you."
"Then have breakfast ready at 7. And we'll take off at 8.
"I will."
He reached into his pocket and extended to her a small, shining disc which she could not distinguish at first. He dropped it on the palm of her hand. It was a $5 gold piece. "The last of your wages for the month," he said. Her fingers snapped closed over the coin too tightly, but she answered calmly and tonelessly,
"Thank you."
Good night, Miss Taggart.
Good night.
She did not sleep in the hours that were still left to her. She sat on the floor of her room, her face pressed to the bed, feeling nothing but the sense of his presence beyond the wall. At times she felt as if he were before her, as if she were sitting at his feet. She spent her last night with him in this manner. She left the valley as she had come, carrying away nothing that belonged to it. She left the few possessions she had acquired, her peasant skirt, a blouse, an apron, a few pieces of underwear, folded neatly in a drawer of the chest in her room. She looked at them for a moment before she closed the drawer, thinking that if she came back, she would perhaps still find them there. She took nothing with her but the $5 gold piece and the band of tape still wound about her ribs. The sun touched the peaks of the mountains, drawing a shining circle as a frontier of the valley, when she climbed aboard the plane. She leaned back in the seat beside him and looked at Galt's face bent over her, as it had been bent when she had opened her eyes on the first morning. Then she closed her eyes and felt his hands tying the blindfold across her face. She heard the blast of the motor, not as sound, but as the shudder of an explosion inside her body. Only it felt like a distant shudder, as if the person feeling it would have been hurt if she were not so far away. She did not know when the wheels left the ground or when the plane crossed the circle of the peaks. She lay still, with the pounding beat of the motor as her only perception of space, as if she were carried inside a current of sound that rocked once in a while. The sound came from his engine, from the control of his hands on the wheel. She held on to that. The rest was to be endured, not resisted. She lay still, her legs stretched forward, her hands on the arms of the seat, with no sense of motion, not even her own, to give her a sense of time, with no space, no sight, no future, with the night of closed eyelids under the pressure of the cloth, and with the knowledge of his presence beside her as her single, unchanging reality. They did not speak. Once she said suddenly,
"Mr. Galt."
"Yes?"
"No, nothing. I just wanted to know whether you were still there."
"I will always be there." She did not know for how many miles the memory of the sound of words seemed like a small landmark rolling away into the distance, then vanishing. Then there was nothing but the stillness of an indivisible present. She did not know whether a day had passed or an hour, when she felt the downward, plunging motion which meant that they were about to land or to crash. The two possibilities seemed equal to her mind. She felt the jolt of the wheels against the ground as an oddly delayed sensation, as if some fraction of time had gone to make her believe it. She felt the running streak of jerky motion, then the jar of the stop and of silence, then the touch of his hands on her hair, removing the blindfold. She saw a glaring sunlight, a stretch of scorched weeds going off into the sky, with no mountains to stop it, a deserted highway and the hazy outline of a town about a mile away. She glanced at her watch. 47 minutes ago, she had still been in the valley. "You'll find a Taggart station there," he said, pointing at the town, "and you'll be able to take a train." She nodded, as if she understood. He did not follow her as she descended to the ground. He leaned across the wheel toward the open door of the plane, and they looked at each other. She stood, her face raised to him, a faint wind stirring her hair, the straight line of her shoulders sculptured by the trim suit of a business executive amidst the flat immensity of an empty prairie. The movement of his hand pointed east, toward some invisible cities. "Don't look for me out there," he said. "You will not find me until you want me for what I am. And when you'll want me, I'll be the easiest man to find." She heard the sound of the door falling closed upon him. It seemed louder than the blast of the propeller that followed. She watched the run of the plane's wheels and the trail of weeds left flattened behind them. Then she saw a strip of sky between wheels and weeds. She looked around her. A reddish haze of heat hung over the shapes of the town in the distance, and the shapes seemed to sag under a rusty tinge. Above their roofs, she saw the remnant of a crumbled smokestack. She saw a dry yellow scrap rustling faintly in the weeds beside her. It was a piece of newspaper. She looked at these objects blankly, unable to make them real. She raised her eyes to the plane. She watched the spread of its wings grow smaller in the sky, draining away in its wake the sound of its motor. It kept rising, wings first, like a long silver cross. Then the curve of its motion went following the sky, dropping slowly closer to the earth. Then it seemed not to move any longer, but only to shrink. She watched it like a star in the process of extinction, while it shrank from cross to dot to a burning spark which she was no longer certain of seeing. When she saw that the spread of the sky was strewn with such sparks all over, she knew that the plane was gone. Chapter 3. Anti-Greed.
"What am I doing here?" asked Dr. Robert Stadler. "Why was I asked to come here? I demand an explanation. I'm not accustomed to being dragged halfway across a continent without rhyme, reason, or notice."
Dr. Floyd Ferris smiled.
"Which makes me appreciate it all the more that you did come, Dr. Stadler."
It was impossible to tell whether his voice had a tone of gratitude or of gloating. The sun was beating down upon them, and Dr. Stadler felt a streak of perspiration oozing along his temple. He could not hold an angrily, embarrassingly private discussion in the middle of a crowd streaming to fill the benches of the grandstand around them, the discussion which he had tried and failed to obtain for the last 3 days. It occurred to him that that was precisely the reason why his meeting with Dr. Ferris had been delayed to this moment, but he brushed the thought aside, just as he brushed some insect buzzing to reach his wet temple.
"Why was I unable to get in touch with you?" he asked.
The fraudulent weapon of sarcasm now seemed to sound less effective than ever, but it was Dr. Stadler's only weapon.
"Why did you find it necessary to send me messages on official stationery worded in a style proper, I'm sure, for army?"
"Orders," he was about to say, but didn't.
"Communications, but certainly not for scientific correspondence."
"It is a government matter," said Dr. Ferris gently.
"Do you realize that I was much too busy and that this meant an interruption of my work?"
"Oh, yes," said Dr. Ferris noncommittally.
"Do you realize that I could have refused to come?"
"But you didn't," said Dr. Ferris softly.
"Why was I given no explanation? Why didn't you come for me in person, instead of sending those incredible young hooligans with their mysterious gibberish that sounded half science, half pulp magazine?"
"I was too busy," said Dr. Ferris blandly.
"Then would you mind telling me what you're doing in the middle of a plane in Iowa, and what I'm doing here for that matter?"
He waved contemptuously at the dusty horizon of an empty prairie and at the 3 wooden grandstands. The stands were newly erected, and the wood, too, seemed to perspire. He could see drops of resin sparkling in the sun.
"We are about to witness an historical event, Dr. Stadler, an occasion which will become a milestone on the road of science, civilization, social welfare, and political adaptability."
Dr. Ferris' voice had the tone of a public relations man's memorized handout.
"The turning point of a new era."
"What event?
What new era?" "As you will observe, only the most distinguished citizens, the cream of our intellectual elite, have been chosen for the special privilege of witnessing this occasion. We could not omit your name, could we? And we feel certain, of course, that we can count on your loyalty and cooperation."
He could not catch Dr. Ferris' eyes. The grandstands were rapidly filling with people, and Dr. Ferris kept interrupting himself constantly to wave to nondescript newcomers, whom Dr. Stadler had never seen before, but who were personages, as he could tell by the particular shade of gaily informal deference in Ferris' waving. They all seemed to know Dr. Ferris and to seek him out, as if he were the master of ceremonies, or the star of the occasion.
"If you would kindly be specific for a moment," said Dr. Stadler, "and tell me what—"
"Hi, Spud," called Dr. Ferris, waving to a portly, white-haired man who filled the full dress uniform of a general. Dr. Stadler raised his voice. "I said, if you would kindly concentrate long enough to explain to me what in hell is going on."
"But it's very simple. It's the final triumph of..."
"You'll have to excuse me a minute, Dr. Stadler," said Dr. Ferris hastily, tearing forward like an overtrained lackey at the sound of a bell in the direction of what looked like a group of aging rowdies. He turned back long enough to add two words which he seemed reverently to consider as a full explanation. "The press." Dr. Stadler sat down on the wooden bench, feeling unaccountably reluctant to brush against anything around him. The three grandstands were spaced at intervals in a semi-curve, like the tiers of a small private circus, with room for some 300 people. They seemed built for the viewing of some spectacle, but they faced the emptiness of a flat prairie stretching off to the horizon, with nothing in sight but the dark blotch of a farmhouse miles away. There were radio microphones in front of one stand, which seemed reserved for the press. There was a contraption resembling a portable switchboard in front of the stand reserved for officials. A few levers of polished metal sparkled in the sun on the face of the switchboard. In an improvised parking lot behind the stands, the glitter of luxurious new cars seemed a brightly reassuring sight. But it was the building that stood on a knoll some 1,000 feet away that gave Dr. Stadler a vague sense of uneasiness. It was a small, squat structure of unknown purpose, with massive stone walls, no windows except a few slits protected by stout iron bars, and a large dome, grotesquely too heavy for the rest, that seemed to press the structure down into the soil. A few outlets protruded from the base of the dome in loose, irregular shapes, resembling badly poured clay funnels. They did not seem to belong to an industrial age or to any known usage. The building had an air of silent malevolence, like a puffed, venomous mushroom. It was obviously modern, but its sloppy, rounded, ineptly unspecific lines made it look like a primitive structure unearthed in the heart of the jungle, devoted to some secret rites of savagery. Dr. Stadler sighed with irritation. He was tired of secrets. Confidential and top confidential had been the words stamped on the invitation which had demanded that he travel to Iowa on a 2-day notice and for an unspecified purpose. Two young men who called themselves physicists had appeared at the Institute to escort him. His calls to Ferris' office in Washington had remained unanswered. The young men had talked through an exhausting trip by government plane, then a clammy ride in a government car, about science, emergencies, social equilibriums, and the need of secrecy, till he knew less than he had known at the start. He noticed only that two words kept recurring in their jabber, which had also appeared in the text of the invitation, two words that had an ominous sound when involving an unknown issue, the demands for his loyalty and cooperation. The young men had deposited him on a bench in the front row of the grandstand and had vanished, like the folding gear of a mechanism, leaving him to the sudden presence of Dr. Ferris in person. Now, watching the scene around him, watching Dr. Ferris' vague, excited, loosely casual gestures in the midst of a group of newsmen, he had an impression of bewildering confusion, of senseless, chaotic inefficiency, and of a smooth machine working to produce the exact degree of that impression needed at the exact moment. He felt a single, sudden flash of panic, in which, as in a flash of lightning, he permitted himself to know that he felt a desperate desire to escape. But he slammed his mind shut against it. He knew that the darkest secret of the occasion, more crucial, more untouchable, more deadly than whatever was hidden in the mushroom building, was that which had made him agree to come. He would never have to learn his own motive, he thought. He thought it, not by means of words, but by means of the brief, vicious spasm of an emotion that resembled irritation and felt like acid. The words that stood in his mind as they had stood when he had agreed to come were like a voodoo formula which one recites when it is needed, and beyond which one must not look. What can you do when you have to deal with people? He noticed that the stand reserved for those whom Ferris had called the intellectual elite was larger than the stand prepared for government officials.
He caught himself feeling a swift little sneak of pleasure at the thought that he had been placed in the front row. He turned to glance at the tiers behind him. The sensation he experienced was like a small, gray shock. That random, faded, shop-worn assembly was not his conception of an intellectual elite. He saw defensively belligerent men and tastelessly dressed women. He saw mean, rancorous, suspicious faces that bore the one mark incompatible with a standard-bearer of the intellect, the mark of uncertainty. He could find no face he knew, no face to recognize as famous, and none likely ever to achieve such recognition. He wondered by what standard these people had been selected. Then he noticed a gangling figure in the second row, the figure of an elderly man with a long, slack face that seemed faintly familiar to him, though he could recall nothing about it except a vague memory, as of a photograph seen in some unsavory publication. He leaned toward a woman and asked, pointing, "Could you tell me the name of that gentleman?" The woman answered in a whisper of awed respect, "That is Dr. Simon Pritchett." Dr. Stadler turned away, wishing no one would see him, wishing no one would ever learn that he had been a member of that group. He raised his eyes and saw that Ferris was leading the whole press gang toward him. He saw Ferris sweeping his arm at him in the manner of a tourist guide and declaring, when they were close enough to be heard, "But why should you waste your time on me when there is the source of today's achievement, the man who made it all possible, Dr. Robert Stadler?" It seemed to him for an instant that he saw an incongruous look on the worn, cynical faces of the newsmen, a look that was not quite respect, expectation, or hope, but more like an echo of these, like a faint reflection of the look they might have worn in their youth on hearing the name of Robert Stadler. In that instant he felt an impulse which he would not acknowledge, the impulse to tell them that he knew nothing about today's event, that his power counted for less than theirs, that he had been brought here as a pawn in some confidence game, almost as a prisoner. Instead, he heard himself answering their questions in the smug, condescending tone of a man who shares all the secrets of the highest authorities. "Yes, the State Science Institute is proud of its record of public service. The State Science Institute is not the tool of any private interests or personal greed. It is devoted to the welfare of mankind, to the good of humanity as a whole." Spouting, like a dictaphone, the sickening generalities he had heard from Dr. Ferris. He would not permit himself to know that what he felt was self-loathing. He identified the emotion, but not its object. It was loathing for the men around him, he thought. It was they who were forcing him to go through this shameful performance. What can you do, he thought, when you have to deal with people? The newsmen were making brief notes of his answers. Their faces now had the look of automatons acting out the routine of pretending that they were hearing news in the empty utterances of another automaton. "Dr. Stadler," asked one of them, pointing at the building on the knoll, "is it true that you consider Project X the greatest achievement of the State Science Institute?" There was a dead drop of silence. "Project X?" said Dr. Stadler. He knew that something was ominously wrong in the tone of his voice, because he saw the heads of the newsmen go up, as at the sound of an alarm. He saw them waiting, their pencils poised. For one instant, while he felt the muscles of his face cracking into the fraud of a smile, he felt a formless and almost supernatural terror, as if he sensed again the silent working of some smooth machine, as if he were caught in it, part of it, and doing its irrevocable will. "Project X," he said softly, in the mysterious tone of a conspirator. "Well, gentlemen, the value and the motive of any achievement of the State Science Institute are not to be doubted, since it is a non-profit venture. Need I say more?" He raised his head and noticed that Dr. Ferris had stood on the edge of the group through the whole of the interview. He wondered whether he imagined that the look on Dr. Ferris' face now seemed less tense and more impertinent. Two resplendent cars came shooting at full speed into the parking lot and stopped with a flourish of screeching brakes. The newsmen deserted him in the middle of a sentence and went running to meet the group alighting from the cars. Dr. Stadler turned to Ferris.
"What is Project X?" he asked sternly. Dr. Ferris smiled in a manner of innocence and insolence together.
"A non-profit venture," he answered, and went running off to meet the newcomers.
From the respectful whispers of the crowd, Dr. Stadler learned that the little man in a wilted linen suit, who looked like a shyster striding briskly in the center of the new group, was Mr. Thompson, the head of the state. Mr. Thompson was smiling, frowning, and barking answers to the newsmen. Dr. Ferris was weaving through the group with the grace of a cat rubbing against sundry legs. The group came closer, and he saw Ferris steering them in his direction.
"Mr. Thompson," said Dr. Ferris sonorously as they approached, "may I present Dr. Robert Stadler?"
Dr. Stadler saw the little shyster's eyes studying him for the fraction of a second. The eyes had a touch of superstitious awe, as at the sight of a phenomenon from a mystical realm forever incomprehensible to Mr. Thompson, and they had the piercing, calculating shrewdness of a ward healer who feels certain that nothing is immune from his standards. A glance like the visual equivalent of the words, "What's your angle?"
"It's an honor, Doctor. An honor, I'm sure," said Mr. Thompson briskly, shaking his hand.
He learned that the tall, stoop-shouldered man with a crew haircut was Mr. Wesley Mouch. He did not catch the names of the others whose hands he shook. As the group proceeded toward the official's grandstand, he was left with the burning sensation of a discovery he dared not face. The discovery that he had felt anxiously pleased by the little shyster's nod of approval. A party of young attendants who looked like movie theater ushers appeared from somewhere with handcarts of glittering objects, which they proceeded to distribute to the assembly. The objects were field glasses. Dr. Ferris took his place at the microphone of a public address system by the official's stand. At a signal from Wesley Mouch, his voice boomed suddenly over the prairie, an unctuous, fraudulently solemn voice, magnified by the microphone inventor's ingenuity into the sound and power of a giant.
"Ladies and gentlemen."
The crowd was struck into silence, all heads jerking unanimously toward the graceful figure of Dr. Floyd Ferris.
"Ladies and gentlemen, you have been chosen, in recognition of your distinguished public service and social loyalty, to witness the unveiling of a scientific achievement of such tremendous importance, such staggering scope, such epoch-making possibilities, that up to this moment it has been known only to a very few, and only as Project X."
Dr. Stadler focused his field glasses on the only thing in sight, on the blotch of the distant farm. He saw that it was the deserted ruin of a farmhouse, which had obviously been abandoned years ago. The light of the sky showed through the naked ribs of the roof, and jagged bits of glass framed the darkness of empty windows. He saw a sagging barn, the rusted tower of a water wheel, and the remnant of a tractor lying upturned with its treads in the air. Dr. Ferris was talking about the crusaders of science, and about the years of selfless devotion, unremitting toil, and persevering research that had gone into Project X. It was odd, thought Dr. Stadler, studying the ruins of the farm, that there should be a herd of goats in the midst of such desolation. There were six or seven of them, some drowsing, some munching lethargically at whatever grass they could find among the sun's scorched weeds. "Project X," Dr. Ferris was saying, "was devoted to some special research in the field of sound. The science of sound has astonishing aspects, which laymen would scarcely suspect." Some 50 feet away from the farmhouse, Dr. Stadler saw a structure, obviously new and of no possible purpose whatever. It looked like a few spans of a steel trestle, rising into empty space, supporting nothing, leading nowhere. Dr. Ferris was now talking about the nature of sound vibrations. Dr. Stadler aimed his field glasses at the horizon beyond the farm, but there was nothing else to be seen for dozens of miles. The sudden straining motion of one of the goats brought his eyes back to the herd. He noticed that the goats were chained to stakes driven at intervals into the ground. "And it was discovered," said Dr. Ferris, "that there are certain frequencies of sound vibration which no structure, organic or inorganic, can withstand."
Dr. Stadler noticed a silvery spot bouncing over the weeds among the herd. It was a kid that had not been chained. It kept leaping and weaving about its mother. The second ray is controlled by a panel inside the giant underground laboratory, said Dr. Ferris, pointing at the building on the knoll. That panel is known to us affectionately as the xylophone, because one must be darn careful to strike the right keys, or rather, to pull the right levers. For this special occasion, an extension xylophone connected to the one inside has been erected here. He pointed to the switchboard in front of the official's stand, so that you may witness the entire operation and see the simplicity of the whole procedure. Dr. Stadler found pleasure in watching the kid, a soothing, reassuring kind of pleasure. The little creature seemed barely a week old. It looked like a ball of white fur with graceful long legs. It kept bounding in a manner of deliberate, gaily ferocious awkwardness. All four of its legs held stiff and straight. It seemed to be leaping at the sun rays, at the summer air, at the joy of discovering its own existence. The sound ray is invisible, inaudible, and fully controllable in respect to target, direction, and range. Its first public test, which you are about to witness, has been set to cover a small sector, a mere 2 miles, in perfect safety, with all space cleared for 20 miles beyond. The present generating equipment in our laboratory is capable of producing rays to cover, through the outlets which you may observe under the dome, the entire countryside within a radius of 100 miles, a circle with a periphery extending from the shore of the Mississippi, roughly from the bridge of the Taggart Transcontinental Railroad, to Des Moines and Fort Dodge, Iowa, to Austin, Minnesota, to Woodman, Wisconsin, to Rock Island, Illinois. This is only a modest beginning. We possess the technical knowledge to build generators with a range of 200 and 300 miles, but due to the fact that we were unable to obtain in time a sufficient quantity of a highly heat-resistant metal, such as Reardon metal, we had to be satisfied with our present equipment and radius of control. In honor of our great executive, Mr. Thompson, under whose far-sighted administration the State Science Institute was granted the funds without which Project X would not have been possible, this great invention will henceforth be known as the Thompson Harmonizer. The crowd applauded. Mr. Thompson sat motionless, with his face held self-consciously stiff. Dr. Stadler felt certain that this small-time shyster had had as little to do with the project as any of the movie-usher attendants, that he possessed neither the mind nor the initiative, nor even the sufficient degree of malice to cause a new gopher trap to be brought into the world, that he, too, was only the pawn of a silent machine, a machine that had no center, no leader, no direction, a machine that had not been set in motion by Dr. Ferris or Wesley Mouch, or any of the cowed creatures in the grandstands, or any of the creatures behind the scenes. An impersonal, unthinking, unembodied machine, of which none was the driver and all were the pawns, each to the degree of his evil. Dr. Stadler gripped the edge of the bench. He felt a desire to leap to his feet and run. As to the function and the purpose of the sound ray, I shall say nothing. I shall let it speak for itself. You will now see it work. When Dr. Blodgett pulls the levers of the xylophone, I suggest that you keep your eyes on the target, which is that farmhouse 2 miles away. There will be nothing else to see. The ray itself is invisible. It has long been conceded by all progressive thinkers that there are no entities, only actions, and no values, only consequences. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you will see the action and the consequences of the Thompson Harmonizer. Dr. Ferris bowed, walked slowly away from the microphone, and came to take his seat on the bench beside Dr. Stadler. A youngish, fattish kind of man took his stand by the switchboard and raised his eyes expectantly toward Mr. Thompson. Mr. Thompson looked blankly bewildered for an instant, as if something had slipped his mind, until Wesley Mouch leaned over and whispered some word into his ear. "Contact," said Mr. Thompson loudly.
Dr. Stadler could not bear to watch the graceful, undulating, effeminate motion of Dr. Blodgett's hand as it pulled the first lever of the switchboard, then the next. He raised his field glasses and looked at the farmhouse. In the instant when he focused his lens, a goat was pulling at its chain, reaching placidly for a tall, dry thistle. In the next instant, the goat rose into the air, upturned, its legs stretched upward and jerking, then fell into a gray pile made of seven goats in convulsions. By the time Dr. Stadler believed it, the pile was motionless, except for one beast's leg sticking out of the mass, stiff as a rod and shaking as in a strong wind. The farmhouse tore into strips of clapboard and went down, followed by a geyser of the bricks of its chimney. The tractor vanished into a pancake. The water tower cracked and its shreds hit the ground while its wheel was still describing a long curve through the air, as if of its own leisurely volition. The steel beams and girders of the solid new trestle collapsed like a structure of matchsticks under the breath of a sigh. It was so swift, so uncontested, so simple, that Dr. Stadler felt no horror. He felt nothing. It was not the reality he had known. It was the realm of a child's nightmare, where material objects could be dissolved by means of a single malevolent wish. He moved the field glasses from his eyes. He was looking at an empty prairie. There was no farm. There was nothing in the distance except a darkish strip that looked like the shadow of a cloud. A single, high, thin scream rose from the tears behind him as some woman fainted. He wondered why she should scream so long after the fact, and then he realized that the time elapsed since the touch of the first lever was not a full minute. He raised his field glasses again, almost as if he were suddenly hoping that the cloud shadow would be all he would see. But the material objects were still there. They were a mount of refuse. He moved his glasses over the wreckage. In a moment, he realized that he was looking for the kid. He could not find it. There was nothing but a pile of gray fur. When he lowered the glasses and turned, he found Dr. Ferris looking at him. He felt certain that through the whole of the test, it was not the target. It was his face that Ferris had watched, as if to see whether he, Robert Stadler, could withstand the ray. "That's all there is to it," the faddish Dr. Blodgett announced through the microphone in the ingratiating sales tone of a department store floorwalker. "There is no nail or rivet remaining in the frame of the structures, and there is no blood vessel left unbroken in the bodies of the animals." The crowd was rustling with jerky movements and high-pitched whispers. People were looking at one another, rising uncertainly and dropping down again, restlessly demanding anything but this pause. There was a sound of submerged hysteria in the whispers. They seemed to be waiting to be told what to think. Dr. Stadler saw a woman being escorted down the steps from the back row, her head bent, a handkerchief pressed to her mouth. She was sick at her stomach. He turned away and saw that Dr. Ferris was still watching him. Dr. Stadler leaned back a little, his face austere and scornful, the face of the nation's greatest scientist, and asked, "Who invented that ghastly thing?"
"You did."
Dr. Stadler looked at him, not moving.
"It is merely a practical appliance," said Dr. Ferris pleasantly, "based upon your theoretical discoveries. It was derived from your invaluable research into the nature of cosmic rays and of the spatial transmission of energy."
"Who worked on the project?"
"A few third-raters, as you would call them.
Really, there was very little difficulty. None of them could have begun to conceive of the first step toward the concept of your energy transmission formula, but given that, the rest was easy."
"What is the practical purpose of this invention? What are the epic-making possibilities?"
"Oh, but don't you see? It is an invaluable instrument of public security. No enemy would attack the possessor of such a weapon. It will set the country free from the fear of aggression and permit it to plan its future in undisturbed safety." His voice had an odd carelessness, a tone of offhand improvisation, as if he were neither expecting nor attempting to be believed.
It will relieve social frictions. It will promote peace, stability, and, as we have indicated, harmony. It will eliminate all danger of war. What war? What aggression? With the whole world starving and all those people's states barely subsisting on handouts from this country? Where do you see any danger of war? Do you expect those ragged savages to attack you? Dr. Ferris looked straight into his eyes. Internal enemies can be as great a danger to the people as external ones, he answered. Perhaps greater. This time his voice sounded as if he expected and was certain to be understood. Social systems are so precarious. But think of what stability could be achieved by a few scientific installations at strategic key points. It would guarantee a state of permanent peace. Don't you think so? Dr. Stadler did not move or answer. As the seconds clicked past and his face still held an unchanged expression, it began to look paralyzed. His eyes had the stare of a man who suddenly sees that which he had known from the start, had spent years trying not to see, and who is now engaged in a contest between the sight and his power to deny its existence. I don't know what you're talking about, he snapped at last. Dr. Ferris smiled. No private businessman or greedy industrialist would have financed Project X, he said softly, in the tone of an idle, informal discussion. He couldn't have afforded it. It's an enormous investment, with no prospect of material gain. What profit could he expect from it? There are no profits henceforth to be derived from that farm. He pointed at the dark strip in the distance. But as you have so well observed, Project X had to be a non-profit venture. Contrary to a business firm, the State Science Institute had no trouble in obtaining funds for the project. You have not heard of the Institute having any financial difficulties in the past 2 years, have you? And it used to be such a problem, getting them to vote the funds necessary for the advancement of science. They always demanded gadgets for their cash, as you used to say. Well, here was a gadget which some people in power could fully appreciate. They got the others to vote for it. It wasn't difficult. In fact, a great many of those others felt safe in voting money for a project that was secret. They felt certain it was important, since they were not considered important enough to be let in on it. There were, of course, a few skeptics and doubters. But they gave in when they were reminded that the head of the State Science Institute was Dr. Robert Stadler, whose judgment and integrity they could not doubt. Dr. Stadler was looking down at his fingernails. The sudden screech of the microphone jerked the crowd into an instantaneous attentiveness. People seemed to be a second's worth of self-control away from panic. An announcer, with a voice like a machine gun spitting smiles, barked cheerily that they were now to witness the radio broadcast that would break the news of the great discovery to the whole nation. Then, with a glance at his watch, his script, and the signaling arm of Wesley Mouch, he yelled into the sparkling snake head of the microphone, into the living rooms, the offices, the studies, the nurseries of the country, "Ladies and gentlemen, Project X." Dr. Ferris leaned toward Dr. Stadler, through the staccato hoofbeats of the announcer's voice galloping across the continent with a description of the new invention, and said in the tone of a casual remark, "It is vitally important that there be no criticism of the project in the country at this precarious time." Then said, semi-accidentally, as a semi-joke, "that there be no criticism of anything at any time." "And the nation's political, cultural, intellectual, and moral leaders," the announcer was yelling into the microphone, "who have witnessed this great event as your representatives and in your name, will now tell you their views of it in person." Mr. Thompson was the first to mount the wooden steps to the platform of the microphone. He snapped his way through a brief speech, hailing a new era and declaring, in the belligerent tone of a challenge to unidentified enemies, that science belonged to the people, and that every man on the face of the globe had a right to share of the advantages created by technological progress. Wesley Mouch came next.
He spoke about social planning and the necessity of unanimous rallying in support of the planners. He spoke about discipline, unity, austerity, and the patriotic duty of bearing temporary hardships. "We have mobilized the best brains of the country to work for your welfare. This great invention was the product of the genius of a man whose devotion to the cause of humanity is not to be questioned, a man acknowledged by all as the greatest mind of the century, Dr. Robert Stadler."
"What?" gasped Dr. Stadler, whirling toward Ferris. Dr. Ferris looked at him with a glance of patient mildness.
"He didn't ask my permission to say that," Dr. Stadler half snapped, half whispered. Dr. Ferris spread out his hands in a